So what do you desire? What do you desire? A lot of interesting ideas about desire. Yeah, some people who believe desire is bad, right? There's other people, they believe desire is good. Some people believe that you should never suppress your desires, even if it means going overboard a little bit. You should never suppress those desires. Lots of interesting ideas out there about desire. And so today what we're going to do is I want to take you to a story that shows us some interesting things about desire. Actually, shows us what happens when desire goes bad. And what happens when desire turns into, well, when desire leads to the sin that we're going to talk about today. It's our last weekend of seven deadly sins. We're going to talk about what happens when our desires go bad and take us into what's known as lust. Say that with me. Ready? One, two, three. Lust. Lust. I know some of you are thinking, finally, one that's interesting. Others of you are thinking, what's the deal? It's Father's Day. Yes, exactly. No, you know what? Listen, everybody struggles in some way with lust, right? It's not just a man issue. Everybody struggles with it. Here's a couple definitions. There's a lot of definitions out there. Here's a couple I'll share with you. One is this: a strong desire to pursue and get for oneself something that one currently lacks so that one can enjoy it by oneself and for oneself. Here's another one: having a self-absorbed desire. You seen a pattern here yet? Having a self-absorbed desire for an object, person, or experience. You notice how much self is in these definitions. Huh? It's about me, myself, and I, right? That's the difference between lust and love, right? Lust is about me. Love is about others. Lust turns me inward. Love turns me outward. We get those confused a lot of times, don't we? Lust and love. So here's the thing. People can have lust for all kinds of things. But let's just be really honest this morning. Just get it right out in the open. We all know that as much as we can have lust about for all different types of things, I think it's safe to say that sexual lust is one that we see surface quite often, right? Yeah, sexual lust. We see it all the time, right? It's kind of that area of lust, sexual lust. It's that area of lust that shows itself most prominently in people's lives. We see it all the time. It's all around us. Our culture uses it to sell us products. TV shows use it to get people to watch it, right? We read about it. We talk about it. It's all over the place. It's probably why Jesus one time said, I think one of the most straightforward things he said anywhere in the scriptures had to do with lust. And he said this, Matthew chapter 5, verse 28. He said, I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Whew. That's heavy, guys, isn't it? Huh? I mean, that's one of those verses, like, if you were going to, like, come up with your own private translation of the Bible, you probably wouldn't include that one. So today I want to talk about lust. I want to talk about lust in the context of, and specifically in this context of sexual lust, because sex is such a powerful force, isn't it? Oh, man, it's a powerful force. And the bottom line is how you deal with that force in your life is going to determine a lot about where your life ends up going, right? You know that to be true, huh? I mean, we saw this great example. This in the news recently, right? Politician. We won't make any jokes about his name, but right, we've seen it all over the place, right? How you deal with sexual lust, man, it can be a huge make it or break it for you in your life. And so to get started, I want to go to the story in the scriptures where we see both good and bad desire. It's Genesis chapter 39, and it's a story about a young man named Joseph. Joseph, you know, the amazing Technicolor dream coat, that Joseph. All right, Joseph is a guy whose brothers sold him into slavery in a fit of jealousy and anger. And he eventually finds himself working for a guy by the name of Potiphar. And Potiphar is kind of like, well, he's kind of like the head of the Egyptian CIA, okay? It's a good way to look at it. And Potiphar has seen such great potential in Joseph's life. And in Genesis chapter 39, let's just read the story here, okay? It says this: Joseph found favor in his eyes, talking about Potiphar, and became his attendant. Potiphar put him in charge of his household, and he entrusted to his care everything he owned. From the time he put him in charge of his household and of all that he owned, the Lord blessed the household of the Egyptian because of Joseph. The blessing of the Lord was on everything Potiphar had, both in the house and in the field. Verse 6, so Potiphar left everything he had in Joseph's care, and Joseph was in charge. He did not concern himself with anything except the food he ate. That's funny. Now, Joseph was well-built and handsome. It's the haughty. And after a while, his master's wife took notice of Joseph and said, come to bed with me. I believe the Hebrew translation of that is something like brown chicken, brown cow. Somebody's like, what do cows have to do with this? It was funny last night. She said, come to bed with me. But he refused. With me in charge, he told her, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house. Everything he owns has been entrusted to my care. No one is greater in this house than I am. My master has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God? Verse 10, and though she spoke to Joseph day after day, he refused to go to bed with her or even be with her. Now, it goes somewhere interesting. One day he went into the house to attend to his duties, and none of the household servants were inside. Oh, 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 oh. She caught him by his cloak and said, come to bed with me. But he left his cloak in her hand and ran out of the house. The dude Forrest Gumped it right out of there, butt naked. Verse 13, when she saw that he had left his cloak in her hand and had run out of the house, she called her household servants. Look, she said to them, this Hebrew has been brought to us to make sport of us. He came in here to sleep with me. Ooh, but I screamed. When he heard me scream for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house. Verse 16, she kept his cloak beside her until his master came home. Oh, she wasn't stopping at all. She'd keep going. Verse 17, then she told him this story. The Hebrew slave you brought us came to me to make sport of me. But as soon as I screamed for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house. Verse 19, when his master heard the story, his wife told him, saying, this is how your slave treated me. He burned with anger. You see, you got to remember, he loved Joseph. There's great trust there. Joseph's master took him and put him in prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. But while Joseph was there in prison, the Lord was with him. He showed him kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden. It's quite a story, isn't it? And Joseph has been brought in by this high official. He rises to become like this, you know, like the COO of this great estate. His career is going well, life's going good, but then one day, sex showed up. He wasn't looking for it. Sex showed up. Oftentimes, that's how it happens, isn't it? Shows up. And so what did Joseph do? Well, let's dive into the story, because there's a lot to learn about lust. A lot to learn about desire, okay? Let's start by looking at Potiphar's wife, because, you know, that's where it all begins, right? What was she doing? Well, it says in verse 7 that the master's wife took notice of Joseph. Now, that word notice is kind of, I think it's too weak of a word, really, to be used here, because noticing isn't necessarily lust. You understand that, right? There's times you just can't help but notice certain things, right? The Hebrew phrase there, in all seriousness this time, is like, it's like she lifted up her eyes to him, that she gazed upon, she contemplated. Okay, so Potiphar's wife, obviously, she's taking a lot of time to contemplate, you know, going to bed with Joseph. She'd gone to bed with him so many times in her mind that she finally said, I got to have the real deal, in spite of the dangers. In spite of his refusal, he says, I gotta have the real deal. And what's interesting here is Joseph's response to her. Joseph's response is not, hey, hold on, time out. This is wicked. This is evil because it's sexual. It's evil. No. He doesn't say that. You know why he doesn't say that? Because sexual desire is not the problem. No, sexual desire is not the problem. The Bible actually says the opposite of that. Did you know that? Yeah, the Bible, in fact, comparatively speaking, the Bible actually holds to a higher view of sex than any other religion or any other holy book in the world. That's right. God invented sex. It was his idea, right? Adam and Eve, he told them what? Be fruitful. Right? In the Old Testament, we see it all over the place. Proverbs chapter 5. Husbands and wives are actually commanded to be ravished and intoxicated with each other sexually. In the New Testament, 1 Corinthians 7, husbands and wives are commanded to be intentional about creating sexual desire for one another. How about Song of Solomon? You ever read Song of Solomon? Some of you look like you need to. Go read that with your spouse tonight. Read it in bed after you put the kids to bed. Read Song of Solomon, right? Listen, God is not a prude. Religion is sometimes, but God is not. No, God created you with sexual desire. God is pro-sex, okay? You know, it's interesting because it's been suggested that the reason why lust is usually not at the top of the seven deadly sins, like others, like maybe pride or envy, wrath, greed, so on, those have always been at the top of the list. And the reason for that, it's been said, is because the moral theologians have always known that like pride and greed and all those types of things, you know, to actually want to hurt someone, to actually want to trample on another person, to actually want to be destructive towards others, that is not what the human heart was built for. All right, in many ways, it's almost like these are like unnatural desires, right? You weren't built to kill. You weren't built to hurt or to destroy, but you were built for sexual desire. And so if anything, okay, what we see from God and what we see from the scriptures is a very strong affirmation when it comes to sexuality. And so having an intense desire sexually is not only not a sin, but in some cases and in the right context, we're actually commanded to have that. Amen. This is good news. Wow. See what our next series is going to be. It's a gift to us from God, okay? And I mean, desire is God's gift to us. You wouldn't even be alive if you didn't have desire, right? You wouldn't ever eat, right? Desire is given to us from God. The problem comes in, and lust shows up in our lives when our desires become disordered. When our desires get messed up, right? Or you could say it this way, lust shows up in our lives when our desires get out of control. That's when lust shows up, when our desires get out of control. I mean, we see it in Potiphar's wife, right? Even though Joseph said no, even though she knew that it was dangerous, she couldn't stop. You know, it's funny to me how people try to downplay the power of sexual desire all the time. That's no big deal. Oh, no, not a big deal at all, right? And it's like, if you think about it, though, there's really no appetite that gets as obsessive as quickly as this one. I mean, you tell me, which one is it? I don't know of one. I love the analogy that one author uses. He says, if you ever found a country where young guys go out to college and they put all these posters up in their rooms of like hamburgers and pizza and hot dogs, and everybody goes running room to room, all the guys are looking at these people. All right? Or if there was a place, you know, a place where you pay money, you go online to watch, as someone like slowly undresses cakes and pies, Hostess cupcakes, things like that, right? Well, if you saw that, you'd assume that this country was filled with starving people, right? I mean, and then you'd be astonished, right? You'd look at that and you'd go, okay, not only are they starving, but the more they eat, the more they want it. Right? Something's not right, right? You'd look at that and you'd say, holy smokes, man, that's an appetite that's gotten out of order. Something is wrong. Something's wrong, right? See, lust shows up when our desires get out of control. Now, we see a couple things, interesting things about lust. In verse 9, Joseph says, my master has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. Well, let's read that one together. Ready? My master has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. Now, you got to understand, okay, Joseph's not saying this in the sense of like, well, the problem here is that you're married. If you weren't married, woo-hoo-hoo, we could go to town. No, that's not what he's saying. The larger point that Joseph's making here is look, you're not mine. I'm not yours. We don't belong to each other. You don't belong to me. I don't belong to you. See, everywhere you look in the scriptures, what you always see is this message right here, that sex is always designed for one man and one woman in the context of a completely exclusive and permanent commitment called marriage. All throughout the scriptures, it's always been one man, one woman. Doesn't matter if only one of them happens to be married, all right, if they're not married to each other, then Houston, we have a problem. All right, we have a problem. See, Joseph says, you're not my wife, right? I mean, see, and why is that important? Well, it's important because, listen, some of you need to hear this. It's important because sex is God's way for us to say to someone else, I'm yours. I belong to you. I belong permanently, exclusively, and completely to you. You belong to me. Sex is God's way for us to say to someone else, I belong exclusively, permanently, and completely to you. See, and God's idea is that that connection doesn't just happen on a physical level. No, he says, if you're going to do it physically, then you better be prepared to do it emotionally. You better be prepared to do it legally and socially and in every other area as well. You better be ready for it, right? And see, when someone says, you know, when someone says they want to become physically one with you, but they don't want to become, but they don't want to be committed to you, you know what they're saying to you? What they're saying is, I don't want to be bound up by you. I don't want to be committed emotionally, legally, okay, or socially, or some other way that makes me not be able to make my own decisions. I don't want to be committed that way. I want to be vulnerable to you physically, but I don't want to be vulnerable to you spiritually. That's what they're saying. You know what really they're saying? Let's just be honest about it. What they're really saying is, I want your body, but I don't really want you. I want to give you my body, but I don't want you. I want to give you my body, but not me. See, that's really what you're saying, right? I mean, lust shows up when we desire pleasure without a promise. Lust shows up. Now, I've been on a roll these last few weeks, so let me just continue. C.S. Lewis, put it this way. C.S. Lewis, maybe you should read him. C.S. Lewis says, having sex without being married, or to want pleasure but without a promise, or want pleasure without commitment. You know what he says? He says it's like trying to eat and taste food and then vomiting it up. That's what he says. It's like he says like trying to eat and taste food and then vomiting up. It's like, and what he's doing is he's comparing this to the person who wants to taste food but doesn't want that food to become a part of them. Right? It's like you don't want the commitment that comes with eating. You don't want to have to deal with the ramifications that come with eating certain things, right? You want to be able to eat White Castle at 12:30 a.m. and still feel okay in the morning. Right? You want all the pleasure, but you don't want any of the responsibility. Folks, that's called bulimia. Right? You eat it, make yourself throw up, you don't want it to affect your body, right? That ravages you physically. Kills you. Unnatural. And see, the same thing, it is just as unnatural to extract physical union from every other kind of union. I mean, you know, to say I want pleasure but without purpose, you're doing the same thing. Think of this. I've shared this a few times, but in the New Testament, the Apostle Paul, he says in 1 Corinthians 6 that when two people have sex, what happens? The two become one. You know what he says in 1 Corinthians? He says that it's not just true when it comes to marriage. He said that's true even if you have sex with a prostitute. The two become one. Same thing. Something happens that is more than physical. There is complete and utter unity. Well, if you're having sex with a prostitute, that ought to feel really uncomfortable right now. But if you're having sex with your spouse and you're married, that should feel pretty awesome, because you know what? I mean, sex is God's way for us to be able to say to someone else, I belong exclusively and permanently and completely to you. So beautiful, right? It's saying, look, we belong. I belong to you, all right? I am not, you are not your own. I am not my own. We are one. That's what marriage is. Lust shows up when we desire pleasure without a promise. Lust also shows up when we desire pleasure without a person. You hear that? See, here's the thing. We get so messed up with this idea of lust and love, right? See, think about this. Love, when it's love, you want a person, right? When it's lust, you just want pleasure. And the person is just sort of a necessary commodity of getting that. People get it messed up all the time. I just love him. Oh, you do? How long have you known him? Like 2 months. No, you don't love him. You don't know. You don't know yet if you love him. Don't tell me you love him. Get out of here. You don't know? Come on. Don't get it confused. If you get it confused, it's really bad, right? Lust and love are not the same thing. When it's love, you want a person, and if for some reason you have to forego pleasure, fine, so be it, right? Because it's about the person. With love, it's the person that is the non-negotiable. With lust, it's the opposite, right? With lust, it's the pleasure that's the non-negotiable, and it's the person that is negotiable. Big, big difference. I mean, think about Potiphar's wife. She proves this. I mean, what happens to her? Well, when she realizes that she can't, you know, get it on with Joseph, what does she do? She turns into evil cougar lady. That's right. She turns evil, right? She becomes murderous. You know why? You know how you know that? Because to accuse Joseph of this at that time, that was a capital punishment. She knew what she was doing. She knew? Are you kidding me? She didn't really love Joseph as a person. Think about that. If she really loved him as a person, she would not have done what she did. She loved the fact that he looked hot, right? She loved the idea of being engaged sexually with him. She did not love him as a person, as a real, true person. I mean, see, that can even happen when you do get the person. Now, there's a story in the Old Testament, 2 Samuel 13, David has a son named Amnon, and who seduces his half-sister. Incest. Yep, seduces her and ends up sleeping with her, and it says that he was sick with love for her. Sick with love. No, he wasn't. He was sick with lust, not love. He was sick with lust. You know how you know that? Because you know what happened? As soon as they had sex, you know what happened? The scriptures say suddenly he hated her with a greater hatred that was greater than the love that he had for her. And so they have sex. You know what he says to her? I'm done. Get out of here. Get out of here. He says, arise and go. Get out of here. Leave me alone. I want nothing to do with you. Call that love? Come on. See, that's what sin does, though, doesn't it? That's what sin does. Sin takes a good thing, a sexual desire which God has given us, and because what it does, though, is it turns it into lust, because it makes it an end to itself, right? Instead of it being about serving someone, right? Instead of learning the pleasure of giving someone pleasure, instead of it being a way of serving someone, instead it becomes an end in itself, and a person ends up becoming just a necessary commodity. So, lust shows up when our desires get out of order. Lust shows up when we desire pleasure without a promise. And lust shows up when we desire pleasure without a person. And that's all I had to say. Have a great day. No, I'm just kidding. So, what do we do about this thing? What do we do about lust? Because you know what? Right now, some of you, it's knocking on your door. Some of you saw it on your Facebook app. When you open your Facebook right now during church. It's everywhere. How do we handle lust when it shows up in our lives? Well, Tell you what, let's look at Joseph, because there's some things we can learn from Joseph, all right? So Cougar goes after Joseph, and what does he do? Verse 10, though she spoke to Joseph day after day, what does it say? Let's read it. He refused to go to bed with her or even be with her. You know what he did? He controlled his actions. Think about that for a second. I mean, what did he do? He refused to be with her. He stayed away from her. He stayed away from temptation. Do you realize that sometimes it is as simple as that? Stay away from temptation. Create boundaries in your life, and don't create the boundaries right there at the ledge where if you fall off, you're done. Create your boundaries a little further back. Artificial boundaries. I mean, look, we spiritualize this stuff so much it makes me sick. Lord, just take away the desire. No, he's not going to do that. You really want him to do that? Go be a eunuch. Really, you want him to do that? He's not going to do that. He created you with that desire. I mean, look, don't over-spiritualize this. You have a problem looking at porn on your computer? Okay, well, how about move the computer in the family room? How about get some software that sends an email to your wife and tells her all the websites you've been on? Oh, yeah, they make such a thing. Email me. I'll give you the link. I've given that to many people. Right? Don't just pray. Look, stop chatting on Facebook with your married people. Stop chatting on Facebook with your ex-girlfriend or ex-boyfriend. It's stupid. Stupid. Wives, let me just go here. Wives, why do some of you put sexual photos of yourself on Facebook if you're married? Why? Stupid. Is that the only place your husband sees it? Stupid. No reason for it. And I know some of you do, because sometimes I look at people who I'm friends with on Facebook, I go, oh, whoa! You wouldn't dress like that in church. You're going to put that all over your Facebook page? Come on, why are you doing that? Why? It's getting hot all up in here. Look, you want to know why I get kind of pissed about this stuff? Because I see the other end of it all the time. I'm sitting down with families, I'm talking to them, and I'm seeing the destruction that is happening in their families. I'm seeing it all the time. It makes me sick. Am I above that? No way. Are you above that? No way. But don't be stupid. Set some boundaries. All right, men, refuse to be alone with a woman who's not your wife. All right, what is it for you? Look, maybe that's not practical. Come up with boundaries. What are yours, right? Women, refuse to be alone with a man who's not your husband. If you're married, don't ride alone in a car with someone of the opposite sex. Don't do it, right? Whatever you got to do. See, it's a lot more practical than we think it is, okay? But Scott, that just seems kind of extreme. Yeah, well, you know what? Maybe it is extreme. Maybe it is. But I'll tell you what, that's not quite as extreme as having to sit down and explain to your children why mom and dad are splitting up because one of you couldn't keep something in your pants. You want to talk about extreme? That's extreme. All right? And look, I mean, is it worth being extreme about? Is it worth it? If you think it's not worth being extreme about that, then you know what, friend? You got greater problems than that. Some things are worth being extreme about. Is it uncomfortable right now in this room? Hell yes, it's uncomfortable. Should it be? Yes, because we're talking about something really great that's at stake here. Mama. The other thing he did, he controlled his actions. He controlled his thoughts. Woo, that's hard sometimes. Yeah, you ever struggle with your thought life? I do. You struggle with yours? See, that's where oftentimes where the challenge is found, right? I love this. There was this author by the name of James Fix. I think he was back in the 80s or something. He wrote a book about running. And marathons. And he says the hardest thing in running a marathon is your mind. Those of us who've run many a marathon. You guys laughing at that? Is that? That's not a joke. It is. It's a lie from the pit of hell. I mean, not that you wouldn't think so. I mean, look at this. Joseph has nothing on this. Anyway, so this guy, he wrote a book about the challenges of running a marathon, how it's in your mind. And he talks about how in the early stages of running a marathon, and in the midst of the marathon, sometimes the fatigue will be so heavy that your mind, you will start saying things like, well, why are you even doing this? Why are you even doing this in the first place? What attracted you to this? And he'd say, when he first started, his mind would say, why are you doing this? And he'd say, I actually don't know. I have no idea. And he talked about how he couldn't remember why. He had no answer. And he talks about how one time he actually dropped out of a race because he couldn't come up with the reason. So he talks about how in the heat of the moment, how your brain will play tricks on you and how your brain will suddenly decide to forget things in the moment and why you love running and why you're doing the marathon, all that. And what he learned was he learned that one of the most important things to do if you're going to stick with it in the hard times, before you even begin the marathon, the best thing you could do is actually memorize the reasons why. Make a song about it. Maybe a rap. Do something. Get it in front of you. But memorize them so when the going gets tough, you know. And then he says, if things get really bad and you're in the heat of the moment and you can't remember, he'd say the final trick that I used to play is I would just say to myself, well, as he's running, well, I don't know right now, but I know that when I get there, I'll remember. I get there. I remember. See, in many cases, I think this is what Joseph does. Right? I mean, I think Joseph, the heat is on, right? I mean, you can't tell me there wasn't temptation. He knew. I mean, he was a man. Come on. I mean, he wouldn't have ran. There was temptation, right? Heat is on. What does he do? Well, he reminds himself of a couple of things. For one, he reminds himself of what we looked at a minute ago. He reminds himself that she's not his wife. Not my wife. But then what? Then in verse 9, and as you keep reading there, it says, how then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God? So here's the thing, like, if in the heat of the moment you find yourself not being able to remember why, just tell yourself this, sex before marriage is wrong, period. I don't remember why, but I'll remember when I get there, right? Tell yourself that, right? See, here's the thing. I mean, look, this is the one thing that for 2,000 years, one of the one things I should say, that the church actually agrees on. Right? I mean, all the sex, not sex, S-E-C-T-S, sex of the Christian faith, okay? Even other religions, Judaism, Islam, Confucianism, all of them, all these centuries and all these great religions disagree on many things, but they all agree on this. They all agree on this. And so what you have to say is, okay, I know there's a good reason, but I can't remember right now, and when I get there, it'll all come back, but for now, I'm going to run, Forrest, run. I'm going to go. But then the other thing that he reminds himself of is he says this would be a sin against God, right? How could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God? How can I do this? Well, what does he mean by that? Because, I mean, obviously, if he has sex with her, then he sins against her. He sins against Potiphar. He sins against himself. But what does he mean by this is a sin against God? Well, here's the thing. Because, listen, this is huge. Because not only is sex both a sign of and a means of achieving complete life unity between two people, but its ultimate goal, listen, the ultimate goal of sex, some of you have never heard this before, the ultimate goal of sex is to give us a taste and a sign of the absolute ecstasy and joy of complete and utter union with our Creator. That's it. Ultimate. A foretaste, a signpost, I guess you could say, pointing us to the unbelievable joy and ecstasy of our union with our Creator. I mean, the Scriptures, Christian theology says it all over the place. Ephesians 5 talks about a husband and wife, when they unite, it's a great mystery, but it's also an illustration of Christ uniting with his people all over the place. Think for a second. Think about for a moment when sex is the best possible that it could ever be. What do you get? You know what you get? You get someone who sees you completely. And when they see you, they don't just tolerate you. They don't say, well, as long as I don't have to look in your face. No, they don't just tolerate you. They take delight in you. Right? In their eyes, you want them to see you as though you are perfect. You want them to see you as though you are holy and without blemish. Do you know why that is? See, look, let me back up. There's a reason a lot of people don't get married. A lot of times it's because they're afraid of what people will see. Right? Because what you really want in sex is someone who will see you and who will take delight in you and who will see you as though you are holy and without blemish. And you want someone whose their arms will come around you and they will hold you in absolute security in that moment of absolute vulnerability. And you want to do the same. See, there's a reason for this. There's a reason. I love Tim Keller. He talks about how this is why people use religious language to talk about sex. Even people who are not religious use religious language to talk about sex. Right? I mean, it's almost like sexual proof in the existence of God. It's funny because, I mean, it's true too. I mean, sex and love, it makes people say things and talk about things that aren't even true, aren't even possible, right? I love you forever, right? I mean, think about some of the songs. Tim Keller calls them drippy love songs, right? You know some of those, right? Right? Longer than there have been fishes in the ocean, right? Higher than any bird ever flew, right? Longer than there's been stars up in the heavens, I've been in love with you, right? Well, that sounds really good, but guess what? That's impossible. That's an illusion, right? No one will ever be able to say, I will never, ever, 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 ever leave you or forsake you. Well, people die. Right? People are sinners, right? Nobody can look at you and see you as holy and without blemish. But who can? Who can? Who can love you like that? Who can say to you, I will never leave you, forsake you? Who can say, in my sight, you are holy and without blemish? Because I died for you, and I have clothed you in my righteousness. Who says that? I'll tell you who says that. Your Creator. The God who loves you with a love that is unfathomable. See, our sexual desire, it points us this direction. It points us to the eternal. And it wants so bad a type of like a cosmic closure that unfortunately no one here on this earth can ever give you. See, that's why as a Christian is someone who says, okay, if my sexual desires, if they're out of control, it's because I'm trying to get closure out of someone who can never truly give it to me. See, this is why I think the key to self-control when it comes to sex is not in thinking about it so negatively, but I think instead it's thinking about it just the opposite, thinking about it so gloriously, so beautifully. See, I think Joseph did. And what happened? God honored that, right? I mean, remember at the very end of that story what it says? Verse 21, it says, the Lord was with him. He showed him kindness and granted him favor. See, some of you, you're where Joseph was at right now. Lust. It's right there, man. It's right there. You go home today, you know it's there. You go to work tomorrow, you know it's there. It's calling you out, man. It is checking you out. Maybe it's your workplace, maybe it's online, maybe wherever it might be. Or maybe some of you, you're more like Potiphar's wife. He's consumed, right? And what you need is you need God to heal you. You need God to heal your heart. And you need God to turn your desires a new direction. Right? Maybe you found yourself stuck in sexual sin. Maybe even as we've talked about this, you've been sitting here and you've been feeling a tremendous weight and you've been feeling almost sick at your stomach. And not even necessarily because of something I've said, but because this has brought out the reality of what's happened in your life. Maybe there's been relationships that have been ruined. Maybe you've messed up your marriage, your family, friendships. Maybe it's a career. Maybe some of you, reputation. Well, what does Jesus say to you? You know what he says? He says the same thing that he said to that woman who was caught in adultery and who was surrounded by all these people who are ready to stone her and to punish her. You know what he said to her? He said, I don't condemn you. Now go and sin no more. See, Jesus called sin what it was. He called sin, sin, right? He said, yeah, you're guilty, but I don't condemn you. All right? See, that's what Jesus says to you today. Are you guilty? Yeah. See, whether it's the sin of lust, maybe it's lust. It's found its way into your life. Maybe it's not even lust. Maybe it's one of the other ones. Maybe it's something we talked about over these last few weeks. Gluttony, pride, sloth, anger, greed, envy, whatever. Maybe it's not even on that list, whatever it might be. But what does Jesus say? Jesus says, yeah, sin is sin. And you know what? The truth is every one of us is guilty. But I don't condemn you. I'm not holding a stone in my hand. No, instead, I offer you forgiveness. And I want to forgive you, and I want to restore you, and I want to recreate you, and I want to take this mess that you have made in your life, and I want to take that pain, I want to take the failures, and what I really want to do is want to begin taking that pain and that failure and even that sin, and I want to use it all to do something beautiful in your life. So today, that's what Jesus says to you. One of the most profound pieces of scripture anywhere is found in the Gospel of Matthew. And you know what you find there at the very beginning? You find this genealogy of Jesus, his family tree, the family tree of the Messiah, you know? And what makes it so profound are some of the names that are listed in that family tree. Names like Tamar, the incest victim. Names like Bathsheba, the adulteress. Names like Rahab. Yep, Rahab, the prostitute. I mean, the fact that there are any women's names on that list is unusual to begin with. It's quite unusual, but you know what? So is the name that follows all of those. The one who says, I don't care what you've done, if you will open your heart, If you will let me in, if you will let me love you, if you will let me pour my mercy and my grace upon your life, then listen, none of that has to be the end of your story. And in fact, I'll even do better than that. I will call you my own. I will share my lineage with you. And I'll take what the world might call and what everyone else around you might call and what even your husband or your wife or people who you thought were your best friends might call ugly and might say you're useless and disgusting because of your sin or unforgivable or stained or whatever it is. And God says, I'll take all of that. You know what I'll do? I'll resurrect it. And yeah, it might be a little bit painful in the process because you know what? It might be tough because you're going to have to get honest about these things. And you're going to have to get honest about it, and you're going to have to let me reach deep down in your life. And you're going to have to let me reach down and begin pulling up those weeds and the roots of those weeds that have taken place in your life. But I promise. That's what he says. I promise that all I'm doing is I'm making room so that I can grow up something even more beautiful to take its place. And whatever that is, man, it will not only redefine you, but it'll reflect who God is to everyone around you. Would you open your heart to him? Let's bow our heads. Let's pray. God, I think sometimes the pain that sin brings into our lives, I think sometimes in our minds, like that pain seems to be actually a little bit less than the pain that it takes to actually get honest with you. and to actually confront our sin. Sometimes that pain of the sin seems not as bad as the pain of actually confronting it. But that's such a lie from our enemy. Because God, on the other side of confronting our sin, on the other side of opening our hearts up and saying, okay, God, do your work, on the other side of that is such freedom. And that's why you said once that you shall know the truth, and the truth will make you free. And God, these past several weeks, just that image that I just keep seeing over and over again is your hand reaching down in the soil of our hearts. And going past those weeds that are on the surface, that are out of control, and your hand is reaching down in our hearts, and you're grabbing the root of those weeds, and you are starting to pull on those. Sometimes that's painful. But God, that's what you want to do. You want to pull those weeds out, and you want to plant something so beautiful in that same soil. Funny thing is that that sin, all that's whatever was there, it's almost like in many ways it's like manure. It actually works as a nutrient. And so the whatever grows up there is actually more beautiful than it would have ever been. And so God begins to redeem even the ugliness of our lives. But we have to open our hearts. We have to invite you. We have to receive from you. And so God, my prayer is that you would give us just a great deal of courage, because I think that's what it takes. Fill our hearts with courage, God. And would you even just right now, just where you're sitting, just let's just take a second. Would you just pray to him, in just between you and him? Would you say, God, I want to open my heart to you? And I'll tell you what, if these past few weeks, if there wasn't something that connected with you, and you, if there wasn't something you saw in your life, then maybe your prayer ought to be, Lord, soften my heart. And I think all of us have felt it. So God, we take a moment, we pray, we ask you to do that. Open our hearts. Fill us with courage. And do your deep work within us. Because what you bring is not condemnation. What you bring is not guilt. What you bring is not shame. What you bring is freedom. What you bring is beauty. So we open our hearts. We receive from you this morning. And we pray that. And we ask that now together in your son's beautiful name. And everyone said, amen. Amen.